Today I'll be talking to you about the occupational health experiences of Hispanic day laborers in New Orleans. The PI of the project is Dr. Marielena Lara, who could not be here today. Something I would like to clarify before starting is that the results I'm going to show you are part of the qualitative analysis that we did on focus groups with day laborers in New Orleans. And this is part of a process to design a community health worker-based health information project. And the results that I will be showing you today are part of the information we'll be using in our design process. Oh, and as of right now, I have no relationships to disclose. Okay, so a little bit of background and stuff that probably many of you already know. The construction industry alone has a larger share of Hispanic workers than any other sector, with the exception of agriculture. And literature shows that, in general, Hispanics are employed in the most hazardous sectors and they have the highest rate of work-related injuries. The factors that contribute to higher deaths and injuries among Hispanics are economic insecurity, poor knowledge of risk, lack of training about safety practices, and employer reluctance to reduce risk at work. And some of our findings echo the literature as well. So the aims of this part of our project are to assess the laborers' knowledge and barriers to utilization of protective equipment, and study the opportunities to improve knowledge among day laborers in the construction industry. Basically, what we wanted to do here is come to day laborers and say, where are you in terms of what you know, what do you need to know, and what is the best way to put it across and help you get where you need to get in terms of long-term and short-term health. So who did we study, and how did we recruit them for this part of our project? Our population of interest are Hispanic day laborers in the city of New Orleans and the great New Orleans parish. The institutional setting or what has allowed us to do this work is the relationship that RAND and Common Ground Health Clinic have established over the past few years, as well as the very, very generous help of the Common Ground Network of Partners, in particular Congress of Day Laborers of the New Orleans Workers Center for Racial Justice, the Oportunidades NOLA Project, and Latino Farmers Cooperative of Louisiana. So who did we include? Mainly, to be part of our focus group, you had to be a Spanish speaker. In other words, you had to prefer Spanish over any other language or be a monolingual Spanish speaker. Most of their employed time would have to be spent in the construction industry, and they would have to provide verbal consent to participate upon recruitment. We repeated the consent process at the focus group, but we required it actually at the point of recruitment. So how did we go about it? We put out flyers, which is the first thing anybody thinks about when you're trying to recruit a population that's scattered like this one. We also went to the places where they wait for work, basically the corners where you will see the laborers waiting to be picked up for work. But also, again, the very very useful network of partners and patients at the Common Ground Clinic. There were some of our focus groups that were entirely word of mouth recruitment, but also through the Common Ground Network. Some of the findings that I'd be happy to talk about later on refer to differences between workers that are part of an organized group and workers that are not part of an organized group when it comes to health awareness. So, how did we go about our focus groups? Well, we did 7 focus groups. We had a total of 51 participants. Initially, we did not expect to find as many female day laborers as we did. As we started to discover the characteristics of this population, we ended up with 1 focus group with female day laborers and 6 focus groups with male day laborers. At the end of each focus group, we had a short anonymous survey. I'll share some of the results with you. The focus group was a language concordance and a structure interview on perceived occupational risks, access to protective equipment, safety information availability, where did they get the information from, and preferences about educational content and training methods. Basically, what do you know? What information do you have about risk? And how much do you know about equipment related to that risk? Do you prefer images? Do you prefer words? Do you prefer both? Do you prefer to talk with somebody on a one-on-one discussion, or would you rather to take your little booklet and go home and read it? What would you like in terms of accessing to health information? So this is the data we use, grounded theory methods for thematic framework analysis. And as those of you who are familiarized with these processes probably know very well, this is an iterative process, requires a lot of back and forth between team members. So I created an initial set of codes for the transcripts of our focus groups, the themes and a draft of the model. We went back and forth with the themes, with the models and themes until we finally arrived to a consensus about what our main themes were and what our main relationships. Okay. So what did our little survey tell us? Now, before I talk to you about these results, there's very little information about the demographics of undocumented or Spanish-speaking day laborers, most of whom are undocumented. So the information we have about their demographic characteristics are from our survey. We have found one or two other studies that have attempted to describe them, and the results are somewhat similar. So what the take-home message of this table is twofold. One, the average age is 36.3 years of age. You usually think of a worker who is a first-generation immigrant as somebody who's young in their 20s. And so this is not the case here, and partly because they have been in the U.S. for, as you can see here, an average of 9.8 years. When it comes to natural disasters, what happened in the particular case of Katrina is that it attracted a lot of unskilled labor for reconstruction. So these were not individuals who were in their home countries. These were individuals who were in the United States, saw an opportunity for work, and migrated to the city. So that's why their length, on average, the length of stay in the United States is 9.8 years. Well, it says 7.2 years of schooling, but in general, we had a lot of variation in terms of that. So we had individuals who could not read and write, and we had teachers in the room, all of whom were day laborers. The country composition of the population was predominantly Honduran, but it was quite a diversity from all over Latin America and the Caribbean. This table, what it shows, we asked them at the end of the survey, what is it that you do at the construction site? When you show up, what is the task that you are assigned to do generally? And they are, in general, non-specialists. They will show up when the construction site is dirty, when there is a lot of work that is non-specialized, that is necessary. So they will say, well, I do general construction work. I just show up and I do whatever they tell me to do. So they said, I do construction, I do reconstruction. They separate, and naturally so, the job of demolition. And why is this an important distinction? These houses or structures that were destroyed during Katrina have been sitting there for 6 years. And as many workers put it to us, it's not the same to come to a house that has been destroyed by a flood and clean it up, tear it apart, and start over, than going into a place that has been stuck with mold for 6 years and had God knows how many contaminants. So most of the work now is moving toward construction, but it's a substantial amount of demolition work to do, and health hazards, health exposures in those sites is greater now than it was back when Katrina had just happened. You will see this does not add to 100 because individuals claim more than one activity at the construction site between 3 and 4 was about the mode. Very few of them had training to work with asbestos. The 4 of them you see there out of the 51 we interviewed were the ones that were trained to work with asbestos. Many of them claimed to work with it but were not trained and did not report it in the survey, though verbally said they had worked with it. So what did we find? In terms of access and utilization of equipment, we found certain facilitators and we found certain barriers. Let me walk you through those. So regarding facilitators, we found that something that made it so much easier for them was, is there access on site, which is kind of tough for many, for those of us who are not in the industry. But turns out that not all employers provide equipment, and not all employers provide equipment to all their employees. And you will see in this quotation, some companies give equipment and others don't. contractors don't give anything. If you are going to work in a dusty place, you have to cover yourself with a shirt or breathe in the dust. Those are your options. So this little statement says a lot because it says, it depends who you work for. So there is a holy grail of employer, the big construction company. One, they have health insurance. So if you fall, break a leg, God knows what can happen to you. They can cover your health insurance sometimes if you are an illegal immigrant. For many of them, if they were covered in case of an accident, it was because it was a big construction company. In their opinion, if you were working for a contractor, you would not get equipment, but some individuals would provide them. The other thing that facilitated on-site access to equipment was community organizations. Something to keep in mind is that attention to New Orleans after Katrina has faded. Right after Katrina, there was a substantial amount of funding for community-based organizations to come out and say, look, here are masks, here are gloves, here's stuff that you can use to protect yourself. That funding has decreased substantially, and some of the feedback we're starting to get from organizations is that these findings are important for them when they submit grants to acquire equipment to give to the laborers. So another facilitator was we observed very different levels of self-efficacy among our focus group participants, and we will measure that once we start our data collection process. And there were two ways in which self-efficacy came out. One is in terms of requesting equipment from your employer. And again, this was one worker who said, when you work for a company, you have to ask the employer to give equipment. This was followed by another statement that said, but don't bother if it's a contractor. Another one said, well, I always carry my mask and gloves in the car just in case. Individuals who are willing to spend the money. And another one who said, to deal with contamination, sometimes you have to go to the store, buy masks and gloves so you don't get hurt. Right? So many individuals were, and there were some very polite disagreements among them on, do you go out there and buy your equipment or not? And many individuals, fewer than you will think, but a substantial number of individuals, they said, well, in the end, what choice do you have? If you want to be safe, go ahead and buy your own equipment. So what barriers did we find? There is what would you expect, financial limitations. It's not easy to be out there buying masks, buying gloves, the right type of shoe, and so on and so forth to protect yourself. So the competing aspect in terms of financial limitations is that people know they have they're exposed to a very risky job. They know that. But when it comes down to choosing what to do, the financial limitations seem to take precedence over their health concerns. And this was a very, very representative of a lot of expressions we got. If an employer comes to the corner and you need to work those hours, we don't think about anything else except about what he's going to pay. They also have another aspect associated to financial limitations are concerns about jobs, which are linked to their legal status and their economic need, of course. So one worker said, sometimes if you ask your employer, the employer says, go home if you don't want to work. Basically, requesting equipment is a signal you send to your employer that you are a little too picky and you don't want to do the job, and you may get fired. The other one was, you have to support your family and have bills to pay, so you do the work without protection to keep your job. And what the reason I think it's quite representative of what came up in the focus group is that individuals were saying they were saying, we make ourselves more attractive to our employers by not being demanding. We want the job. We want you to hire us. I won't give you trouble. Just let me do the job and pay me. Another barriers were perceptions about equipment. One person told us this mask does not protect at all. You always end up with dust on your face. The reason, it seemed from the focus group that part of the reason this perception came up quite a bit is that they got one type of mask, the basic dust protection mask, and they would use that mask for different jobs, whether you're doing, where you're painting with oil paint in an enclosed environment, or whether just sanding wood. Regardless of the activity, you get the same mask. So that kind of seemed to help develop the perception that these masks do not work, and they tend to dismiss the use of masks. The other point was this one was pretty good. Imagine working with this heat. This was a focus group in the middle of summer in New Orleans, for those of you who have been there. Imagine work with this heat inside a house, doing sheetrock and wearing a plastic mask on your face. It is horrible. So they have, what he said after was, like, you want to be free when you're doing your job. I have 2 minutes, so I will go very quickly through the next slides. So the other one was, well, employers do not provide equipment, which goes back to what we were talking about before. So what did we find about occupational health knowledge? There's very rarely offers for training. Again, if you work for a big construction company, you're more likely to get training than if you work for individual contractors or individuals who just want to redo their house. But also distance to training locations. They live in high-risk, high-crime areas, so it's very hard for them after work to move into a location where they can get training without the risk of being robbed or something worse. This part refers to current resources regarding knowledge. These are not the ideal resources. It is where they get their information from. And one is individual experience. This one guy said, well, the dust from the sander gets you so sick that I used to wake up with blood in my nose. Sometimes at night, because of the dust or insulation, you can't close your eyes. They burn too much. So they know there's something off with the things they're exposed to, and they tend to share that information with other workers, which leads me to the other point. The other source is peer experience. And they will narrate the experience of people that they know or people that they heard of as a way of bringing up examples of the things that they think are the most risky about their jobs. So what we found in terms of how we can help is, one, they want to see what is it that's going to happen given the exposures that are present in their everyday job lives. They want to know what kind of equipment they can use to protect themselves. There is absolutely no knowledge, for example, of basic concepts such as silica and what it is and where it is. You find it everywhere in a construction site, and how they can protect themselves from it. Something that was very important for our study is how they want to get the information across. One is via media. We have adjusted our intervention to include a video-based arm for our trial, and also talked with a community health worker, also we refer to them as promotores. It's for one-on-one instruction, but also because there is a good chunk of our population who are not literate, we will rely, or our intervention will rely more strongly on images rather than the traditional NIOSH handout of high literacy, lots of words type of handout. So I'll just end this up. So these were basically our findings. Thank you so very much. So one of the advantages of the, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the CHW model, but the CHW model is based on the idea that the person that provides the training is from the community. So many of a Common Ground, our partner in New Orleans, is very well embedded in the community, and we have actually started to talk to men and women who are part of the community, who know where workers are, if they move, where they move, and what is the best way to reach them. So in terms of access, it is, in our experience, it has been working with people who are already part of the community, as opposed to bringing in outside researchers to try to figure out what's going on. One, because it's more effective that way, but two, because people don't want to talk to somebody who doesn't know what they're going through. and are more willing to open themselves up. And if you have to do follow-up with somebody who moves from their current location, they're more willing to get back to you in terms of follow-up interviews or calls. So it's basically an approach that is based on current community resources. Right, and one of the wonderful things we discovered is that there were female day laborers who were very interested in doing the training work, which was something we were concerned about because there is evidence that gender concordance tends to affect outcomes. So we got lucky enough to one, figure out how men felt about being trained by women, but also having both men and women willing to participate in the training process.
That's a very good question. I see the question is related to clinical importance of the scores. Okay. The maximum score of CESD is 33, and so it's spread from 0 to 33, and there is no cutoff point for severe depression or not. So I think that is the very important question because that difference may not have a clinical importance in terms of depression. However, I don't have the standard deviation in the table, but the general trend, the gap is getting bigger and bigger as the time goes by, yeah, between those groups. So, the unstable group, maintaining unstable group score is almost 16, and the best group, the depressive score is 13. So 2 or 3 points may not be a clinically important. However, the trend, I see the trend of the gap between those groups. So that's a very important point.
Messages about the EAP services being available to help people cope with discrimination and their stress.
Sure.
Can you each speak to how resiliency, how you see resiliency functioning and how you might integrate that in future research on this topic? Brian, do you want to start?
Certainly. One of the motivating factors behind this study, just in case the rest can hear, was we tend to work with a lot of people who ask us, given this economy, what would we see, what do we expect to see in terms of people going out on short-term disability? So we would get, people would ask what we think is going to happen. Well, you can ask your actuaries, but they would tell us, I heard that people are afraid to go out on disability leave because they're afraid of losing their job. Or you'd hear that people are so stressed at work that it's exacerbating the other kinds of conditions that they have, and they're more likely to take a short-term disability leave. Oh, by the way, I heard on NPR this thing. And that's how we started looking at it. So this idea of resiliency, it's becoming more important if you start thinking about people who are out on some kind of long-term absence and their ability to return to work. And it looks like, to the extent that people have higher levels of stress, which may be a part of the, you know, how they reflect on the larger economy, which may be a part of how they perceive the work context, which may be a part of the contingent status of their work, it tends to have these longer tail exacerbating effects. And again, you know, I come from an institute where we focus on employers and their relationship to their employees. This is part of the argument that we say the evidence is very compelling that there's a lot more at stake. We ask employers to be self-interested. There's more at stake in your health, resiliency, levels of stress, how you organize your work for people, than you may realize. And that if you scrimp here, scrimp there, it pays off badly for you in the long run. Thank you.
Well, I mean, I was just going to say that only some employers offer EAP programs. And so for those who don't, that's just something that we need to do more research on to see what other resources are out there other than EAP programs for, say, employers who don't have, I guess, the funding or the ability to do such things. So aside from EAP programs, what else is out there to deal with, you know, employers who are dealing with personal issues or workplace issues?
Are they generally even across for the companies that do have them? Would there be some variation?
Generally they contract out with counselors. There are coordinators, but sometimes employees don't feel comfortable talking with someone who's associated with their employer. So EAP programs often contract out with counselors so the employer can go out and have, so they can feel that it's more confidential.
Yeah, I totally agree with you in terms of the importance of resiliency. And I see that economic status itself is a good source for resiliency, because that may help people plan their future, and they can keep their psychological stability, and they can maintain hope for the future. So in our research, that economic situation itself works as a source for resiliency. That was our one of the conclusions. And my interpretation for the highest depressive score for the unstable group might be learned helplessness, because it's a behaviorism. Behavior perspective, they have no future, and year by year they have in the same situation of unstable employment status. So as the year goes by, their depressive mood is a kind of result of learned helplessness. So well, I can link that helplessness with resiliency, that economic situation can work as a resiliency resource to decrease the learned helplessness. That was our interpretation. Okay.
We have not assessed resiliency in our study in general, and I think this is something I am. I would not be surprised if this were the case, but in general, individuals who have low levels of schooling and undertake the task of migrating for low-skilled labor tend to have higher levels of resiliency. But circumstances do weigh on how that changes over time. And what we have seen is that there is substantial, there is a lot of room for community-level institutions and research organizations to help mitigate exogenous factors that might be affecting long-term levels of resilience in these groups. We found that people who just had just given up over time, that they were very optimistic when they first started working because they pay better than in other states. They get more work than in other states. But over time, it had become so burdensome that they had lost all hope of anything better. But we find also that there are individuals who are there, say, who will come up in pretty much in every focus group and say, but if I knew what's going on, I can come up to my employer and say, look, if I go in there the way you want me to go in there, this is what's going to happen to me. Give me that whole bodysuit or give me that mask. So there is room for improvement in that end.
Thank you.